All that night she cried and cried, but when the sun came up, she was flooded with clarity. "I am so fucking out of here," she decided. "I don't know how, but I'm getting out." It wasn't obvious how she could escape. She had been placed in RPF in March. Now it was September. There hadn't been time to plan because she was working constantly. She didn't know where to turn. It didn't occur to her to call her parents because she was so apprehensive that she might bring shame on Scientology if anybody knew what had happened to her. In any case, she was forbidden to speak to anyone outside the RPF, even to other Sea Org members. And even if she did escape, she realized, she actually knew very little about what was going on in the world. Since she had joined Scientology at the age of 14, she had never read a book that hadn't been written by L. Ron Hubbard. Taylor managed to slip away to visit her 10-month-old daughter in the child care org across the street. To her horror, she discovered that Vanessa had contracted whooping cough, which is highly contagious and occasionally fatal. The baby's eyes were welded shut with mucus, and her diaper was wet. In fact, her whole crib was soaking. She was covered with fruit flies. Taylor recoiled. The prospect of losing both her unborn baby and her daughter seemed very likely. She finally conceived a plan, explaining to her guards that she had to telephone the doctor. She managed a brief call to Travolta's office and asked Kate Edwards to meet her the next day at a certain time, giving the address of the child care org. She hung up without even hearing Edwards' response. The next day, she was allowed a brief visit to the nursery. Taylor put an extra diaper in her purse. She had 4 dimes, all the money she had in the world, and a toothbrush. Fortunately, Edwards arrived right on time. Taylor explained to her Scientology escort that Edwards was her sister-in-law who had come to take Vanessa to the doctor. "Is this approved?" he asked. "Oh, absolutely." Taylor opened Edwards' door and handed her the baby. Edwards stared in bewilderment as Taylor loudly told her to call as soon as she found out what the doctor said. Then, under her breath, she added, "Kate, when I shut this door, please drive away as quickly as you can." Edwards nodded. Then Taylor jumped in. Edwards hit the gas. "Spanky, no!" the escort cried. Taylor hadn't planned any further than this. She was still dressed in a man's black boiler suit with the sleeves and legs rolled up. Edwards fetched some clothes from her mother that would fit Taylor's emaciated frame and picked up some diapers for Vanessa, then checked them into the Tropicana Hotel on Santa Monica Boulevard. Taylor finally called her husband in the Guardian's office. Another executive picked up the line. "Spanky, they're looking for you everywhere. Where are you?" he demanded. "I want to talk to Norm," she said. "You need to come back." Taylor said she would call back at 11 that night. This time, her husband answered. "Are they there?" Taylor asked him. "Yes." She hung up. After an hour or two, she called again. He said he was alone. She told him she was out of the church and not going back. The baby was safe, she said. Norm wanted to meet, and Spanky finally told him where she was. She realized their marriage was probably over, but she felt she owed him that. Norm came over to the Tropicana, and they spoke for several hours. The next morning at 9, there was a knock on the door of Taylor's hotel room. 3 Sea Org executives were there to haul her back to RPF. Taylor still believed in the revelations of her religion. She worried that her salvation was at stake. But she was also gripped with fear that her baby and her unborn child were in mortal danger. At first, she was firm in telling the men that she wasn't coming back. "If you lay a hand on me or my child, I'm filing charges," she cried. They assured her they just wanted to talk. They told her that they hated to see her be declared a suppressive person. She would be cut off from any other Scientologist, nearly everyone she knew. There was a proper way to rout out, they reminded her. Eventually, Taylor agreed to return to the office to file the paperwork that would allow her to leave the Sea Org on good terms and still be a Scientologist. As part of the routing process, Taylor was given a confession to sign detailing all the crimes she had committed. She glanced at the document. Some of the actions cited were drawn from her pre-clear folders, things she had confessed to her auditors that were supposed to remain confidential. She knew how it worked. She says she had once been assigned to go through members' folders and circle any evil intentions toward Scientology. Sexual indiscretions or illegal acts were always highlighted. These would be forwarded to the Guardian's office to be used against anyone who threatened to subvert the church. If the crimes weren't sufficiently damning, Taylor came to learn, scandalous material would simply be manufactured. She signed her confession without really reading it. Later, she was given her bill. The theory of the freeloaders tab is that people who join the Sea Org don't have to pay for the cost of auditing and the coursework to move up the bridge. The truth is that there is never much time to take advantage of such instruction. Taylor had been in the Sea Org for 7 years, however, and the bill for the services she might have taken amounted to more than $100,000. Just before she left the office, the executive handling her case was called away for a moment. Taylor took her confession off his desk and stuffed it in her purse. When she finally left the building, she tore it to pieces. When Hubbard found out Yvonne Gillam was dying, he sent her a telex asking if she wanted to keep her body or move on to the next cycle. She decided it would be quicker just to let go, but she still wanted the auditing. Hubbard agreed to let her travel to Clearwater to do an end of cycle on her hats, meaning that she would brief her successor at the Celebrity Center before she died. Hannah Eltringham was stationed at Flag, and she was shocked at the sight of her dear friend. Yvonne was dizzy and frequently lost her balance, and her thoughts trailed away. She refused to take pain medication because it would interfere with her auditing. She tearfully blamed herself for the terrible overt of dying and deserting Hubbard. She was desperate to see her children, to say goodbye, but they were kept away. Hubbard designated Catherine Harrington, one of Yvonne's closest friends, to talk to her about the celebrities in her care. Who was a reliable speaker? Who was good at recruiting other celebrities? Yvonne talked about various people, some television actors, a Mexican pop singer, the producer Don Simpson, Karen Black, Chick Corea, and Paul Haggis, among others. But she was particularly worried about Travolta. "Please help him. He's especially sensitive," she said. She advised Harrington to deal with the celebrities the same way she treated Hubbard, very delicately and with an open mind. Gillam died in January 1978. Spanky Taylor's son, Travis, was born that March, weighing less than 3 pounds, although he was carried to full term. Both of Taylor's children are alive and healthy today. Many former Sea Org members found their departure from the church to be tangled in confusion, panic, grief, and conflicting loyalties. Many still cling to a relationship with the church, sometimes for years, like Taylor, or for the rest of their lives. The coda to Taylor's story is that a year after leaving the Sea Org, she traveled to Houston to meet with Travolta. He was filming Urban Cowboy at the time. On her own initiative, she came to recover him for the church. She had heard that he was having problems in his life, and she worried that her own troubles had prevented him from turning to the church for help. It was also possible that if she brought Travolta back into the fold, her standing in the church would be improved. Like most celebrities, Travolta had been shielded from the church's inner workings. The scandals that periodically erupted in the press about Hubbard's biography or his disappearance or the church's use of private investigators and the courts to harass critics, these things rarely touched the awareness of Scientology luminaries. Many simply didn't want to hear about the problems inside their organization. It was easy enough to chalk such revelations up to religious persecution or yellow journalism. "There are two sides to the story, but I don't know both sides," Travolta blithely said when he was asked about Operation Snow White. "I'm not involved with that." In any case, for someone like Travolta, who was so publicly associated with the church, it would be hard to just walk away. He had been asked to declare himself publicly, and he had done so again and again. The star was staying in a private house in Houston. He and Taylor met in the evening after dinner over a plate of chocolate chip cookies that she had brought. She explained that she had left the Sea Org and was with her children now, then quickly changed the subject and asked about him. He described the problems he was having. Former Scientologists have given conflicting accounts of Travolta's stressful relationship with the church at that time. The church hierarchy was desperately concerned that their most valuable member would be revealed as gay. At the same time, the hierarchy was prepared to use that against him. Bill Franks, the church's former executive director, told Time magazine that Travolta was worried that if he defected, the church would expose his sexual identity. Jesse Prince has stated that Travolta was threatening to marry a man, although that wasn't a legal option at the time. In Frank's opinion, the church had Travolta trapped. At one point, the star sought assurance from Franks that his private confessions wouldn't be used against him. "My sessions are protected, right?" he asked Frank. In truth, intelligence officers inside the church had already been directed to gather material, called a dead agent pack, that would be used against Travolta if he turned. In Houston, however, Travolta told Taylor that he didn't really feel that he needed to be recovered. He was just taking a break. However, Taylor did persuade him to buy a costly package of auditing so that he could get back on the bridge. He had stopped his coursework after completing OT3. After that, Taylor received a letter from Hubbard saying, "Well done." The founder asked if there was anything she needed. She asked nothing for herself, but begged Hubbard to do a folder error summary on Travolta, in which the founder would personally review all the star's auditing over the years to spot any mistakes. A tremendous honor for any Scientologist. A messenger assured her that it would be done. Not long afterward, however, Travolta stopped talking to Taylor. She got a call from Priscilla Presley, who asked what was going on. Presley had run into Travolta, and he had said that they should get together. "I'll call Spanky," Presley had told him. "No, don't go through Spanky," Travolta said. When Spanky heard this, she realized she had been declared a suppressive person. Nobody had bothered to tell her, but from now on, no Scientologist would be allowed to talk to her. Taylor never tried to speak to Paul Haggis again, worried that she might compromise his relationship to the church. For his part, Haggis had no idea what had happened to Spanky. He wondered why she had just disappeared. But Scientologists were always drifting in and out of his life. Sea Org members, even friends like Spanky, might be suddenly posted somewhere else without explanation, or assigned to Clearwater for advanced training, or sent to a secret Sea Org base where they were rarely in contact with the outside world. That might explain her absence. He didn't inquire. He readily identified with the church's narrative that Scientology was being victimized by an intolerant and uncomprehending press, self-serving politicians, careerist bureaucrats, and reactionary police agencies looking for headlines. By publicly defending Scientology, he took on the great burden of scorn and ridicule routinely directed at the church. And in that way, he also allied himself with persecuted minorities everywhere. He was one of them. If he had known that his friend had been declared a suppressive, Haggis would have had a different choice to make. It was one he would face soon, in any case. In 1983, Haggis's writing partner on the TV series Different Strokes, Howard Myers, who was also a Scientologist, decided to follow a splinter group led by David Mayo, who had been one of the highest officials in the church. Haggis told Myers that he couldn't work with him anymore. Because Myers was the senior writer on the show, Haggis resigned and went looking for other work. Chapter 5. Dropping the Body. Hubbard never lost his interest in being a movie director. He wrote innumerable scripts for Scientology training films, but he still thought he could take over Hollywood. He had particularly high hopes for one script, Revolt in the Stars, that was based on one of his novels. Inspired by the thunderous success of Star Wars, Hubbard worked on the script in 1979 with the legendary acting teacher Milton Katselis, with the aim of having it made into a feature film. A journeyman theater and film director before taking over the Beverly Hills Playhouse, Katselis had directed the 1972 film Butterflies Are Free, starring Goldie Hawn and Edward Albert. Eileen Heckert won an Oscar for Best Actress in a Supporting Role. He was a vital link to the Hollywood celebrity machine that Scientology depended upon. The list of his protégés included Al Pacino, Goldie Hawn, George C. Scott, Alec Baldwin, Ted Danson, Michelle Pfeiffer, Gene Hackman, George Clooney, and many other now familiar names. His invitation-only Saturday Masterclass was seen by many young actors as a portal to stardom. He attained OT-5 status and was one of the most profitable sources of recruits for the church, receiving in return a 10% commission on the money contributed by his students. At one point, Katselis asked if he could join the Sea Org, but Hubbard told him it was more important to continue doing what he was doing. When Katselis and Hubbard finished the script of Revolt in the Stars, Hubbard dispatched one of his top messengers, Catherine Harrington, to Hollywood to make a deal. After the Moroccan adventure, Hubbard had appointed her his personal public relations officer. Harrington came from a moneyed background, and she knew how to talk about finances. She shopped the script around and found a buyer willing to offer $10 million, which at the time would have been the highest price ever paid for a script, she was told. The Guardian's office became suspicious and investigated the buyers, who they learned were Mormons. Hubbard figured that the only reason Mormons would buy it was to put it on the shelf. Harrington wound up being sent to the RPF, and when she balked at that, she was demoted even further, to the RPF's RPF, alone, in the furnace room under the parking garage of the Clearwater base. The script never did get made into a film. Hubbard's location was a deep secret. Scientologists who asked were told he was over the rainbow. Meantime, a full-fledged movie studio, the Cine Org, was set up in a barn at Hubbard's La Quinta hideaway. With his usual brio, Hubbard assumed that he was fully capable of writing, producing, and directing his own material, but his novice staff often frustrated him. He would do scenes over and over again, exhausting everyone, but he was rarely satisfied with the outcome. He walked around the set, bellowing orders through a bullhorn, sometimes right in the face of a humiliated staff member. Hubbard was becoming increasingly cranky and confused. He slept with guards outside his door, hiding in the tamarind trees that flanked his cottage. One morning he accused the messenger outside his door of abandoning his post. "Someone came in and exchanged my left boot for a boot half a size smaller," he said. "They even scuffed it up to make it look the same. Someone is trying to make me think I'm crazy." In an effort to lighten the mood, several of the crew made up a comic skit and gave a video of it to Hubbard. He was offended. He was sure they were mocking him. "He was shouting at the TV," one of his executives recalled. "He sent the messengers to find the names of everyone involved." One of the perpetrators of the skit was a cocky young camera operator named David Miscavige. Only 17 years old, Miscavige had already been marked as a rocket within the church. He spent his early years in Willingboro, New Jersey, a suburb of Philadelphia. It was one of the mass-produced Levittowns built in America after World War II. He and his older brother Ronnie played football in a children's league for a team called the Pennypacker Park Patriots. Despite his athleticism, David was handicapped by his diminutive size and severe bouts of asthma, which caused numerous trips to the emergency room. His father, Ron Miscavige, a salesman at various times of cookware, china, insurance, and cosmetics, was the first in the family to be drawn to the work of Hubbard. Frustrated with the ineffective treatment his son was getting for his asthma, Ron took David to a Dianetics counselor. "I experienced a miracle," David later declared, "and as a result, I decided to devote my life to the religion." But in fact, asthma continued to afflict him, and his disease was at the center of the Miscavige family drama. Soon, Ron and his wife Loretta and their four children were getting auditing at the Scientology mission in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Ronnie Jr. was the oldest of the children, followed by the twins, David and Denise, and the youngest, Lori. In 1972, the family moved to England in order to take advanced courses at the church's worldwide headquarters at St. Hill. At the age of 12, David became one of the youngest auditors in the history of the church. The Wonder Kid, he was called. The following year, in June, Ron and Loretta had to return to the United States for a couple of weeks. They needed someone to take care of David while they and the other children were gone. There was another American studying at St. Hill, Irvin Scott, whose wife was also afflicted with asthma. His memory is that he agreed to let the boy stay with him. He recalls that in the first encounter, David's parents, along with his twin sister, met with him before they left. Scott immediately liked the family. The father was wonderful and bright. The mother was very beautiful with high affinity. And the daughter was the cutest thing. David, however, sat at the end of the couch, unsmiling, with his arms crossed. The family wanted to make sure that Scott knew what to do in case of an intense asthma attack. They said, "We have to warn you about Dave," Scott recalled. "David has episodes, very unusual episodes." The parents explained that Dave became extremely angry when he was suffering an asthma seizure. Then they said, starting with the husband, "When these episodes occur, do not touch him." The mother reiterated, "Yes, please don't touch him." I said, "What happens?" They said, "David gets very, very violent, and he beats the hell out of you if you touch him." And the sister says, "Oh my God, he does beat you really hard." Again and again, the family members emphasized that David had beaten them during an attack. Scott glanced at David, who, he recalls, nodded in agreement. "He seemed almost smug," Scott remembers thinking, "like he was arrogantly proud of kicking their ass." Scott was puzzled. He had never heard of asthma making a person violent. In his experience, a person in the grip of such an attack was frozen with fear. He said he would heed the warning, however. The next morning, David moved in. Scott took him shopping and then to a pub where he bought him a Coke. Scott also got a non-alcoholic drink. They chatted with some other Scientology auditors, and David began to warm up. He seemed pleased to be around auditors, but Scott felt that there was a certain falseness in his behavior. They went back to Scott's quarters and watched television, then turned in around 10. Scott placed David in the bed by the window, which was cracked to give him some fresh air. David went right to sleep. Scott was used to the rattle of asthmatic breathing, so he soon fell asleep as well. Scott remembers hearing a scream around 1 o'clock. He jumped up and turned on the light. David was leaning on the bed with one arm. His face was blue and his eyes were rolled back. Scott had never seen anything like it. He started to touch him but drew back and performed a Scientology assist. He said, "That's it, David. Come up to present time," repeating the command twice. David blinked and then jolted awake. He was still disoriented, so Scott performed another Scientology exercise called a locational. "Look at that wall. Look at that bed." Slowly, David began to focus. Finally, he asked Scott, "Did I hit you?" "No." "Phew." David was still groggy and quickly went back to sleep, but Scott was unsettled. He watched the boy for another hour before drifting off again himself. In the morning, David remembered nothing of what had happened during the night. He got ready to take a shower. When he took off his pajama top, Scott did a double take. He had never seen a 13-year-old boy with such muscles. "This kid is built like Arnold Schwarzenegger," he thought. "A young, very small Arnold Schwarzenegger." While David was in the shower, Scott took a look at the medication on his nightstand. He remembers seeing 2 bottles and 2 inhalers. One of the inhalers was a typical over-the-counter medication, but all the others contained steroids. Scott had grown up on a farm, and he had used steroids to treat some diseases in animals, but also to build up the muscle mass in cattle. Could that have had the same effect on Miscavige? Actually, asthma medications often use corticosteroids, which do not have the same effect as the anabolic steroids that weightlifters and athletes employ. Corticosteroids can stunt growth, however, and if Miscavige took them, might have contributed to his short stature. Scott decided to write a knowledge report about what he had seen, which would go to the ethics officer. "Here is a Scientologist, and he's taking drugs, and he's having these very bad episodes of asthmatic attacks that can and should be handled by auditing." He also asked for David's pre-clear folder, which should have a record of his previous auditing. He was told that David didn't have a PC folder. Scott had never heard of a Scientologist without one. Scott worked with David on some of his coursework and training drills. At times, the teenager struck him as highly intelligent, but robotic, and there were some concepts he couldn't seem to grasp. For instance, with the most basic e-meter drill, which was simply to touch the meter and then let go, Scott recalls that David's hand was shaking. "David, relax. This is just a drill," Scott said. David settled down, and they continued the drill, but Scott was troubled. The boy was supposed to be a qualified auditor, but he didn't seem to be trained at all. According to Scott, David admitted that he had never audited anyone, and that, in fact, he had never even been audited himself. "Auditing is for weaklings," he said. In any case, he said, he was clear from a past life. Scott wrote up another knowledge report. The course supervisor was strangely impatient with Scott for taking extra time to get Dave through the drills. There was something else that was peculiar, too. A photographer kept following David around. Later, Scott learned that a Scientology magazine was preparing an article about the youngest auditor to complete an internship in the Sea Org. Scott was complicating matters by holding up David's progress. Scott remembers that on Monday, David audited a pre-clear. When he came back to the room, he seemed agitated, and Scott asked him what was going on. "Those fucking women," Scott remembers David exclaiming. "There should be no women in the Sea Org." Scott learned that there were three women who were overseeing David's internship at St. Hill. David's attitude toward women was deeply troubling, as Scott noted in yet another knowledge report. So far, no one in the ethics office had responded. That changed a few days later. Scott was called into the ethics office and told that David had complained that Scott was interbulating or upsetting him and causing problems because of the abundant reports he was writing. "This kid is an SP," Scott warned, "and you better handle him." Then he opened the door to leave. David was standing just outside. His reaction told Scott that he had overheard him calling him a suppressive person. "He went into total fear," Scott said. That very day, David was moved into another room, and his parents soon returned from the United States. But David avoided Scott whenever they passed each other. In August, Scott was sitting out in the yard across from the castle and the auditing rooms on the St. Hill grounds. He was talking to a friend of his, a Norwegian nurse. Suddenly they heard a young woman wailing. Scott remembers looking up and seeing David, his face red and the veins visible in his forehead. He had a pre-clear folder under his arm. Behind him was the crying girl who was holding her side in apparent pain. According to Scott, the nurse exclaimed, "He beat up his PC!" Karen De La Carrier was also a young intern at St. Hill, and she was directed to join the others in the internship room. "They told us that David Miscavige had struck his PC," she recalled. "He had been removed from his internship, and we were not to rumor-monger or gossip about it. We were supposed to just bury it." David was not done with Scientology, however. At 15, he went clear in his present life. On his 16th birthday in 1976, sickened by the declining moral situation in schools illustrated by rampant drug use, he dropped out of 10th grade and formally joined the Sea Org. He began his service in Clearwater. Less than a year later, he was transferred to the Commodore's Messengers in California, where once again he quickly captured the attention of the church hierarchy with his energy and commitment. He rose to the position of chief cinematographer at the age of 17. After the skit that made such a poor impression on Hubbard, David redeemed himself in the founder's eyes by renovating one of his houses and ridding it of fiberglass, which Hubbard said he was allergic to. David Miscavige filled a spot in Hubbard's plans that once might have been occupied by Quentin, although Miscavige displayed a passion and focus that Quentin never really possessed. He was tough, tireless, and doctrinaire. Despite David's youth, Hubbard promoted him to action chief, the person in charge of making sure that Hubbard's directives were strictly and remorselessly carried out. He ran missions around the world to perform operations that local orgs were unable to do themselves, at least not to Hubbard's satisfaction. Footnote. Miscavige has been circumspect about what missions he actually performed in his capacity as action chief. He once testified, "What is a mission? Okay. Well, you have a situation, and a situation is defined as a departure, major departure from the ideal scene, and at the bottom of that there's some why. Why is defined as an explanation that opens a door to a handling. And if you have actually pulled the strings on the situation all the way down, you will now have a why, which means that the situation can be resolved. A mission would take a situation, knowing what the why is, and therefore knowing what exact handling steps are thus possible as a result of the door being opened, because the why was found by evaluation and they would operate on what is known as a set of mission orders and the set of mission orders is an exact series of steps, sometimes consecutive, sometimes not. Sometimes they can be done concurrently within each other. These mission orders have an exact purpose to be accomplished, exact major targets, exact primary targets, exact vital targets, exact operating targets. They have listed the means of mission communication, and they have also listed the target date for completion. He did not clarify the situation further. David Miscavige testimony, Bent Corydon versus Church of Scientology, July 1990. End footnote. Hubbard finished writing his 1,000-page opus, Battlefield Earth, in 1980. Mitt Romney would name it as his favorite novel. Hubbard hoped to have the book made into a major motion picture, so the executive director of the church, Bill Franks, approached Travolta about producing and starring in it. Travolta was excited about the prospect. Suddenly, Franks got a call from Miscavige saying, "Get me John Travolta. I want to meet that guy." Miscavige began wining and dining the star. "He just moved in and took over Travolta," Franks recalled. But he says that privately, Miscavige was telling him, "The guy is a faggot. We're going to out him." Fleeing subpoenas from 3 grand juries and pursued by 48 lawsuits, all naming the founder, Hubbard slipped away from public view on Valentine's Day 1980 in a white Dodge van with velvet curtains and a daybed. It had been customized by John Brousseau, a Sea Org member who took care of all of Hubbard's vehicles. The elaborate escape plan involved ditching the Dodge for an orange Ford. In the meantime, Brousseau purchased another Dodge van for Hubbard, identical to the first. He then cut the original one into pieces and took them to the dump. The Ford was chopped up and dumped as well. Hubbard briefly settled in Newport Beach, California, in a one-bedroom apartment with a kitchenette. In the apartment next door were Pat and Annie Broker, his 2 closest aides. Pat, a handsome former rock and roll guitar player, enthusiastically adopted the role of an undercover operative, running secret errands for Hubbard and going to any length to keep their location a secret. His wife, Annie, one of the original Commodore's messengers, was a shy blonde, totally devoted to Hubbard. Hubbard soon decided that the Newport Beach location was compromised, so the 3 of them hit the road. Pat drove a Chevrolet pickup with a 40-foot Country Air trailer, which mainly contained Hubbard's wardrobe, and Annie piloted a luxurious Bluebird mobile home that John Brousseau had purchased for $120,000 in cash under a false name. The Bluebird towed a Nissan pickup that Brousseau had converted into a mobile kitchen. For most of a year, this cumbersome caravan roamed the Sierras, lighting in parks along the way. At one point, Hubbard bought a small ranch with a gold mine, but he didn't really settle down until 1983 on a horse farm in Creston, California, population 270, outside San Luis Obispo, near a spread owned by the country singer Kenny Rogers. He grew a beard and called himself Jack Farnsworth. Hubbard had been used to receiving regular shipments of money, but after he took flight, the entire structure of the church was reorganized, making such under-the-table transfers more difficult to disguise. Miscavige ordered that $1 million a week be transferred to the founder, but now it had to be done in a nominally legal manner. One scheme was to commission screenplays based on Hubbard's innumerable movie ideas. That way, Hubbard could be paid for the treatment, about $100,000 for each idea. 50 such treatments were prepared. Paul Haggis was one of the writers asked to participate. He received a message from the old man asking him to write a script called Influencing the Planet. The script was supposed to demonstrate the range of Hubbard's efforts to improve civilization. Haggis co-wrote the script with another Scientologist, Steve Johnstone. What they wanted was really quite dreadful, Haggis admitted. Hubbard sent him notes on the draft, but apparently the film was never made. Meanwhile, Miscavige consolidated his position in the church as the essential conduit to the founder. Miscavige's title was Head of Special Project Ops, a mysterious post, and he reported only to Pat Broker. Miscavige was 23 years old at the time, and Broker a decade older. As gatekeepers, they determined what information reached Hubbard's ears. Under their regency, some of Hubbard's most senior executives were booted out. People who might have been considered competitors to Miscavige and Broker in the future management of the church, and replaced by much younger counterparts. Miscavige and Broker would communicate in code on their pagers. At any hour of the night, John Brousseau, who was Miscavige's driver, would take him to one of the several designated pay telephone booths between Los Angeles and Riverside County to wait for a call revealing the rendezvous point. It was usually a parking lot somewhere. The drivers of the two men would wait while Miscavige and Broker talked, sometimes for hours. Gail Irwin, who had been on the Apollo when she was 16 years old and had risen to being the head of the Commodore's Messengers Org, began to wonder what was going on. Hubbard's dispatches had become increasingly paranoid, and his only line of communication to the outside world was through these two ambitious young men. Nearly every one of the original messengers who had joined Hubbard on the Apollo had been purged. David Mayo, who was Hubbard's personal auditor, had also been shut off from contact. He, too, became suspicious of Miscavige and ordered him to be security checked, but Miscavige refused this direct order from a superior. Gail Irwin says she confronted him, and Miscavige knocked her to the ground with a flying tackle. The church denies all charges of Miscavige's abuse. Brousseau got a call from Irwin. She was agitated. She told him that Miscavige had gone psychotic. She said she had to contact Pat Broker right away for a meeting. When Brousseau asked to talk to Miscavige, Irwin began shouting orders at him, saying that Miscavige was raving and had to be restrained. In no way could Brousseau talk to him. He must arrange the meeting with Broker immediately. Brousseau drove her to a prearranged payphone outside a Denny's restaurant in San Bernardino, which was used only for emergencies. As they waited for the call from Broker's driver, a black Dodge van came barreling into the parking lot and slammed to a halt between Brousseau's car and the phone booth. The doors blew open, and half a dozen men spilled out of the van, including David Miscavige. Irwin says that Miscavige used a tire iron to pummel the payphone without much effect. Finally, he was able to yank the receiver off the cable. Miscavige ordered Irwin into the van, and she meekly acquiesced. With this action, the coup was accomplished. Miscavige and Broker were now fully and defiantly in control of Scientology. The founder was isolated, caged by his notoriety and paranoia. No one knew if the orders coming from over the rainbow were from Hubbard or his lieutenants, but now it no longer mattered. Irwin was busted. A year later, in 1984, Miscavige declared her a suppressive person, which would happen to nearly every one of the original messengers, the most trusted circle of Hubbard's advisors. David Mayo was sent to the RPF. He was made to run around a pole in the searing desert heat for 12 hours a day until his teeth fell out. There was one last obstacle that Miscavige had to remove. In 1979, as a result of the FBI raid, Mary Sue had been charged and convicted of conspiracy along with 10 other Scientology executives and sentenced to 5 years in prison, despite the evidence that her health was in decline. She suffered from chronic pancreatitis, a painful condition that made it difficult to digest food. She was frail and thin and completely oblivious to anything she had done wrong, recalled a Scientologist who escorted her into the back door of the courthouse in Washington. She said, "I don't want to be photographed." That was more important to her than the fact that she was going to jail for 5 years. While her case was on appeal, Mary Sue was placed in a comfortable house in Los Angeles, well away from Hubbard. She posed a dilemma for the church, and particularly for her husband. Hubbard was concerned that he might be indicted by a grand jury in New York that was looking into the church's harassment of Paulette Cooper, the journalist who had written The Scandal of Scientology. If Mary Sue were sufficiently alienated to implicate Hubbard, Scientology would be devastated. Hubbard dictated frequent letters telling her what to say to prosecutors. The letters would be read to her and then destroyed. A crew of messengers spent weeks sorting through all the orders and correspondence relating to Operation Snow White and other possible criminal activity that the FBI had not seized, making sure that Hubbard's name was excised from any damning evidence. Mary Sue still commanded the loyalty and affection of many Scientologists who saw her as a martyr. Moreover, she refused to divorce Hubbard or to resign her position as head of the Guardian's office. The sprawling intelligence apparatus that she built still operated in secret, behind locked doors. The Commodore's Messengers Org and the Guardian's office were parallel and sometimes competing arms of their founders, and they had often struggled for power in a kind of bureaucratic marital spat. Now that Miscavige was fully in control of the CMO, he concluded that the GO had to be ripped out of Mary Sue's grasp, but without upsetting her to the point that she sought revenge. In the spring of 1981, a delegation of Commodore's messengers, including Miscavige and Bill Franks, went to meet Mary Sue at a conference room in the Westin Bonaventure Hotel in Los Angeles. Each of them wore a hidden microphone. Miscavige's audacious plan was to seize control of the GO and place it under control of the messengers, who numbered only about 50 at the time. Several thousand guardians were still working for Mary Sue. She had treated them kindly, paying them decent wages and allowing them to live in private homes. Most of them remained loyal to her and thought that she was being made a scapegoat. They would have to be purged. Mary Sue received the delegation of messengers coolly. Her case was still on appeal, but the outcome was clear. She was taking the fall for a program that Hubbard, after all, had put in motion. She understood the influence she still wielded in the church and the threat she represented. She demanded to deal with Hubbard himself, but Miscavige refused. He controlled access to the church's founder so thoroughly that even his wife couldn't talk to him. Indeed, they hadn't spoken in more than a year. Mary Sue cursed Miscavige and threatened to throw a heavy ashtray at him, but her negotiating position was not strong unless she was willing to betray everything she had worked to build with the man she still believed was a savior. It must have been galling for her to negotiate with Miscavige, who was 21 at the time, the age Mary Sue was when she married Hubbard. Privately, she called him Little Napoleon. In exchange for her resignation from the GO, the messengers offered a house and a financial settlement. Mary Sue had substantial legal bills and no other means of support. Under the guise of having to sort out the messes that would be left behind in the wake of her resignation, Miscavige went over a number of different subjects, even including a couple of murders that were alleged to have been committed by a member of the GO office in London. He wanted Mary Sue on tape, confessing to other crimes, which could then be fed to the government. This was done, Bill Franks asserts, with Hubbard's knowledge. Hubbard wanted her out of the way. He wanted all guns pointed at her so he could go about his old age without worrying about being thrown in jail. Mary Sue lost her last appeal. She began serving a 5-year sentence in Lexington, Kentucky, in January 1983. Hubbard never visited her in prison. Her letters went unanswered. "I don't believe he's getting them," she later reasoned. Mary Sue was released after serving 1 year. She never saw her husband again. Many people who joined the church under Hubbard would later contend that Miscavige's machinations were opposed to the will of the founder. But there is evidence that Miscavige was acting on Hubbard's direct orders. Jesse Prince says that when Hubbard was angry at someone, he would command Miscavige to hit or spit on them, then report back when he had done so. Larry Brennan, who was a member of the church's watchdog committee in charge of dealing with legal affairs, had seen how a minor infraction could be inflated into a major offense that justified the most severe penalty. There were no mistakes, there were only crimes. Every action was intended. This logic brooked no defense. Once a week, after Hubbard disappeared, Brennan had to drive 90 miles southeast of Los Angeles to the little town of Hemet in order to write up confidential reports to be sent to the missing leader. The church operated a secret base there in a former resort known as Gilman Hot Springs. Two Sea Org bases are located on the old Gilman Resort, Gold and Int. Gold Base is named after Golden Era Productions, the lavishly equipped film and recording studio set up by Hubbard to make his movies and produce Scientology materials. Int Base is the church's international headquarters. On the north side of the highway, nestled against the dry hills, is Bonnie View, the house that Hubbard hoped one day to live in. Miscavige keeps an office on the property. Few Scientologists and almost no one outside of the church knew of its existence. The local community was told that the bankrupt property on California Highway 79 had been purchased in 1978 by the Scottish Highland Quietude Club. Most of the Sea Org members on the base had no idea where they were. They had been transported there overnight from the former base at La Quinta in a deliberately circuitous route. Gold Base was the only place deemed secure enough for Brennan to send his dispatches. Brennan says that in late 1982, he witnessed Miscavige abusing three Scientology executives who had made some small error. The three offenders were lined up before their leader. According to Brennan, he punched the first one in the mouth. The next, he slapped hard in the face. He choked the third executive so hard that Brennan thought the man would black out. No explanation was offered. This came at a time when Hubbard was furious that his legal situation left him in limbo, and he was upset about the church's finances. Brennan had access to all the correspondence coming from Hubbard to the watchdog committee, and he knew that Hubbard was demanding action. "He wanted a head on a pike," Brennan said. Brennan says that after the beating, the three executives were held as prisoners on the base. The church categorically denies all charges of Miscavige's abuse. They were assigned lowly tasks, and Sea Org members spat on them whenever they passed. Later, one of the three men approached Brennan in tears, worried about what might happen to him. "He had to have great courage just to speak to me, because they were not allowed to speak unless spoken to," Brennan recalled. "I had Hubbard's orders in my hand to spit on him. I couldn't do it." In December 1982, David Miscavige married Michelle Shelley Barnett, a slight blonde, 21 years old. She had been one of the early Commodore's messengers on the Apollo. She was quiet, petite, and younger than most of the other messengers at the time, about 12 when she joined, and a bit overshadowed by the older girls. "She was a sweet, innocent thing thrown into chaos," one of her shipmates recalled. John Brousseau was married to Shelley's older sister, Clarice, and one day he proposed that the two couples go fishing. Miscavige had never been. They drove up to Lake Hemet, a glacial lake in the mountains above Gold Base. It was a beautiful spring day. The sun was glinting off the water. A mild breeze was blowing. The wildflowers were out and birds were singing. Everyone was dressed in shorts or jeans. They had brought sandwiches and sodas for a picnic. Brousseau baited the poles with salmon eggs and then showed the others how to cast. He said to just let the line sink to the bottom and then sit back and wait. Maybe a trout would take a bite. Brousseau recalls looking over at Miscavige 5 minutes later. He was visibly shaking. His veins were bulging. "You got to be kidding me," he said. "This is it? You just sit here and fucking wait?" Brousseau said that was the general idea. "I can't stand it," Brousseau remembers Miscavige saying. "I feel like jumping in and grabbing a fish with my fucking hands, or cramming the hook down their fucking throats." That was the end of the fishing trip. After Quentin's suicide and Mary Sue's prison sentence, the remainder of Hubbard's family broke apart. His oldest daughter, Diana, had been Hubbard's main supporter. She and her husband, Jonathan Horwich, lived at Flag Base in the Fort Harrison penthouse in Clearwater with their daughter, Roanne. As her father became increasingly remote, Diana decided to try her luck as a singer and songwriter. She released a soft jazz album titled Lifetimes in 1979, using notable Scientologist musicians, including Chick Corea and Stanley Clark, as backup. The cover features her in a black dress, lips parted, arms crossed, her pale shoulders hunched, and her waist-length red hair stirring in the breeze. Although the album received little notice, Diana decided to leave her husband and the Sea Org and marry John Ryan, a public Scientologist who had produced her record. She moved to Los Angeles to dedicate herself to music. Horwich agreed to the divorce, but he refused to part with Roanne, who was 2 years old at the time. Hubbard strongly supported this decision, but Mary Sue was opposed. She wanted her granddaughter to be nearby, and she began agitating for Diana to gain custody. Several missions were sent to bargain with Diana, but she was unmoved. Finally, Jesse Prince got the assignment. It was a do-or-die mission, he recalled. If he didn't succeed in gaining clear custody of Roanne for Horwich, he would be sent back to the RPF. For whatever reason, Diana signed the release he put in front of her. Hubbard was thrilled. He rewarded Prince with a leather coat, a gold chain, some cash, and an M14 assault rifle. Suzette, Diana's younger sister, was increasingly disaffected. Quentin's death had been a blow, but the fact that there had been no ceremony afterward, his name was essentially erased from family history, left her embittered and wary. She longed for the warmth of her St. Hill childhood, when her mother would read to her and her father would laugh and toss her in the air. Those days were long gone. The forces pulling her family apart were far too powerful for her to resist. She wanted nothing more than to walk away and start a family of her own. But that was not so easily done. She had tried to elope with another Sea Org member she had met years before in Washington. "We had fallen in love and wanted to get married and live together for the rest of our lives," her suitor, Arnaldo Lerma, later said. He flew to Clearwater. They got blood tests and a marriage license. Suzette then confessed the plan in an auditing session. "She spilled the beans, and I got arrested, well, detained," Lerma said. "I remember being in a room with a chair and a light bulb and two guys outside the door. I was interrogated for several hours. I was not struck, hit, or physically abused. However, what I do remember is the deal I was offered. We will give you a guarantee of safe passage out of the state of Florida with all body parts attached. If you tell Suzette Hubbard, the marriage is off." Lerma did as he was told, leaving the church as well. Later, when Hubbard learned about another man Suzette was interested in, he paid him to leave her alone. She was isolated and desperately lonely. She did finally get married to a Scientologist named Michael Titmus in 1980, when she was 25, but her father didn't trust him either. Titmus was sent to RPF and denounced as an infiltrator. Suzette was told to divorce him, which she did. Soon after that, she was transferred to Gold Base to work in the household unit, cleaning rooms and doing the laundry, for David Miscavige, among others. In 1985, with Hubbard in seclusion, the church faced two of its most difficult court challenges. In Los Angeles, a former Sea Org member, Lawrence Wallersheim, sought $25 million for emotional distress caused by brainwashing and emotional abuse. He said he had been forced to disconnect from his family and locked for 18 hours a day in the hold of a ship docked in Long Beach, California, deprived of sleep and fed only once a day. After attaining OT3 status, Wallersheim said, his core sense of identity had been shattered. At OT3, you find out you're really thousands of individual beings struggling for control of your body, aliens left over from space wars that are giving you cancer or making you crazy or making you impotent, he later recalled. I went psychotic on OT3. I lost a sense of who I was. In order to substantiate the charges, Wallersheim's attorney introduced Scientology's most confidential materials, including the OT3 secrets, as evidence. At this point, those materials were still unknown to the general public. The loss of Scientology's chest of secrets was not just a violation of the sanctity of its esoteric doctrines. From the church's perspective, open examination of these materials represented a copyright infringement and a potential business catastrophe. Those who were traveling up the bridge would now know their destination. The fog of mystery would be dissipated. The Wallersheim suit had been filed in 1980, but Scientology lawyers had been frantically dragging it out with writs and motions. An undercover campaign was launched to discredit or blackmail Wallersheim's lawyer, Charles O'Reilly. His house was bugged, and his office was infiltrated by a Scientology operative. There was an attempt to trap him or his bodyguards in a compromising situation with women. The church also harassed the judge in the case, Ronald Swearinger. I was followed, the judge later said. My car tires were slashed. My collie drowned in my pool. A former Scientology executive, Vicki Asnaran, later testified that there was an effort to compromise the judge by setting up his son, who they heard was gay, with a minor boy. When the case finally came to trial, the church stacked the courtroom with OT-7s. They thought OT-7s could move mountains, Tori Christman, a former Sea Org member, said. Although she was only an OT-3 at the time, she persuaded church officials to let her into the room. The Scientologists directed their intentions toward the judge and the jury, hoping to influence their decisions telepathically. On a Friday afternoon, the judge announced that the OT-3 documents would be made public at 9 a.m. the following Monday on a first-come, first-serve basis. This was the disaster the church had been dreading. When the courthouse opened that Monday, there were 1,500 Scientologists lined up. They filled three hallways of the courthouse and overwhelmed the clerk's office with requests to photocopy the documents in order to keep anyone else from getting their hands on the confidential materials. They kept it up until the judge issued a restraining order at noon, pending a hearing later in the week. Despite these efforts, the Los Angeles Times managed to get a copy of the OT3 materials and published a summary of them. A major cause of mankind's problems began 75 million years ago, the Times account begins. In a studiously neutral tone, the lengthy article reveals Scientology's occult cosmology. The planet Earth, formerly called Tegeac, was part of a confederation of planets under the leadership of a despotic ruler named Xenu. Although the details were sketchy, the secrets that had stunned Paul Haggis were suddenly public knowledge. The jury awarded Wallersheim $30 million. Footnote. In 1989, an appellate court reduced the judgment to $2.5 million, which the church finally paid in 2002, plus interest, which brought the sum to $8.6 million. End footnote. Worse than the financial loss was the derision that greeted the church all over the world and the loss of control of its secret doctrines. The church has never recovered from the blow. The other court challenge that year involved Julie Christofferson Tichborne, a young defector who had spent her college savings on Scientology counseling. She argued that the church had falsely claimed that Scientology would improve her intelligence, creativity, communication skills, and even her eyesight. For the first time, much of Hubbard's biography came under attack. The litigant said that Hubbard had been portrayed as a nuclear physicist and civil engineer. The evidence showed that he attended George Washington University but never graduated. In response to Hubbard's claim that he had cured himself of his injuries in the Second World War, the evidence showed that he had never been wounded. Other embarrassing revelations came to light. The church stated that Hubbard was paid less than the average Scientology staff member, at the time about $15 a week. But witnesses for the plaintiff testified that in 1 6-month period in 1982, about $34 million had been transferred from the church into Hubbard's personal bank from a Liberian corporation. Footnote, the church claims that Hubbard's income was generated by his book sales. End footnote. One former Scientologist described training sessions in which members were hectored or teased over sensitive issues until they were desensitized and would no longer react. In two such instances of bull baiting, Christofferson Tichborne saw the 8-year-old son of the registrar repeatedly put his hands down the front of a woman student's dress and a female coach unzipping the pants of a male student and fondling his genitals. The jury seemed most disturbed by testimony that members of the Guardian's office had culled the auditing files of members looking for salacious material that could be used to blackmail potential defectors. Christofferson Tichborne had originally sought a $30,000 refund from the church. The jury awarded her $39 million. At the time, that sum could have bankrupted Scientology. That evening, Miscavige and other members of the church hierarchy had a gloomy meeting in a condo in Portland, Oregon. One of the executives vowed that Christofferson Tichborne would never collect because he was going to kill her. "I don't care if I get the chair," he said. "It's only one lifetime." There was a lengthy silence, and then Miscavige said, "No, here's what we're going to do." And on the spot, he came up with the Portland Crusade. As many as 12,000 Scientologists came from all over the world in May and June 1985 to protest the judgment in what they called the Battle of Portland. Day after day, they marched around the Multnomah County Courthouse shouting, "Religious Freedom Now!" and carrying banners reading, "We Shall Overcome!" Chick Corea flew in from Japan to play a concert, along with other musicians affiliated with the church, including Al Jarreau, Stanley Clark, and Edgar Winter. Stevie Wonder phoned in and sang, "I Just Called to Say I Love You," as the crowd cheered. The most notable presence in Portland was John Travolta. It was a decisive moment in his relationship with the religion, The church had made enormous efforts to persuade him to attend. 2 years before the Portland Crusade, Travolta had told Rolling Stone that although he still believed in Scientology, he had not had any auditing for the past year and a half. When asked if he was being exploited by the church to promote its cause, he responded, "I've been something of an ostrich about how it's used me because I haven't investigated exactly what the organization's done. One part of me says that if somebody gets some good out of it, maybe it's all right. The other part of me says that I hope it uses some taste and discretion. I wish I could defend Scientology better, but I don't think it even deserves to be defended, in a sense." But here he was in Portland, unshaven and exhausted, having flown his own plane in at midnight for a 2-hour visit. "Once in a while, you have to stand up for what you believe in, and I'm here tonight. I've had counseling. I give counseling, and I don't want to lose that," he declared. And it's as simple as that. The Portland March was one of the greatest triumphs in Scientology's history, capped by the judge's declaration of a mistrial. He ruled that Christofferson Tichborne's lawyers had presented prejudicial arguments to the jury by saying that Hubbard was a sociopath and that Scientology was not a religion but a terrorist organization. Church members who had been in Portland would always feel an ecstatic sense of kinship. A year and a half later, the church settled with Christofferson Tichborne for an undisclosed sum. For years, Hubbard's declining health was a secret known to few in the upper levels of the church. Only a handful of his closest followers were allowed to see him. He had made no clear arrangements for a successor, nor was there any open talk of it. There was an unstated belief that operating thetans did not grow frail or lose their mental faculties. Old age and illness were embarrassing refutations of Scientology's core beliefs. Death was a subject that Hubbard rarely addressed, assuring Scientologists that it was of little importance. "If you had an automobile sitting out here on the street and you came out totally expecting to find this automobile there and it's gone, it's been stolen and so forth, you'd be upset," he said in 1957, reflecting on the death of one of his close followers. "Well, that's just about the frame of mind a thetan is usually in when he finds his body dead. The thetan has to report to a between lives area," Hubbard later explained, "which for most of them is the planet Mars. There, the thetan is given a forgetter implant." "The implant is very interesting," Hubbard later wrote. "The pre-clear is seated before a wheel which contains numbers of pictures. As the wheel turns, these pictures go away from him. The whole effect is to give him the impression that he has no past life. The thetan is then sent back to Earth to pick up a baby's body as soon as it is born. The baby takes its first gasp, why a thetan usually picks it up. Sometimes there is a shortage of new bodies, and occasionally a thetan will follow a pregnant woman around, waiting for the moment of delivery, so he can pounce. Contrarily, when a body dies, it's important for the thetan to be freed as quickly as possible, preferably by cremating the corpse and scattering the ashes in water so that nothing clings together." "It's very confused, this whole subject of death," Hubbard observed. "It's quite funny, as a matter of fact, the amount of this and that is paid, the amount of flowers and that sort of thing which are shipped around at dead corpses after the thetan has shoved off, and so on. It's very amusing." He presented himself as an expert on the subject, claiming he had been pronounced dead but had come back to life on 2 or 3 occasions.